The latest edition of Time Magazine has an article. It's an in-depth article on society, The New Face of Gay Power. Of course, it's 5 years after the death of Matthew Shepard, the University of Wyoming student that was picked up by two men, taken out into a remote area, and beaten to death. Matthew Shepard was gay. He's become something of, and I don't mean this to offend anyone, but he has become something of the patron saint of the gay movement. We're going to be talking with Pastor Marcus Zill during this first half hour of Issues Etc. He's pastor of St. Andrew's Lutheran Church and Campus Center in Laramie, Wyoming, where the University of Wyoming is located. In the second half hour of the program, Dr. Jeffrey Satinover joins us. He's well qualified to deal with a startling news study that has been published widely, that people might be born gay. We'll find out whether or not that is true and how well the research that is often reported to support a gay gene or an hereditary origin to homosexuality, how well that research really supports the way it's reported. Dr. Jeffrey Satinover in the second half hour of the program. In the second hour, Peter LaBarbara joins us from Illinois Family Institute. The Illinois Human Rights Act, what is it? It's somewhat shrouded in mystery. We'll find out what it's all about, and we'll spend just a few minutes talking with him in the second hour. Open lines follows that. Cal Thomas has weighed in on Rush Limbaugh and, well, the very bad week that Rush Limbaugh had last week. If you've been listening lately, he's not talking much about this supposed investigation that is pending against him for purchasing prescription drugs illegally. Cal Thomas says, look, even if the allegations are true, it doesn't diminish Limbaugh's arguments, but Rush ought to come clean. He ought to come clean. I'll share that column with you during Open Lines, and I've got a question for you. The new conceal and carry gun law, everyone's talking about this. Businesses are trying to find ways of keeping people from bringing their concealed guns within their doors onto their property. I wondered about this morning when I was listening to the radio. They were talking about the police department providing no firearms signs to businesses. And I wonder, you know, this is a radio station. We lock the doors here. No one gets in this place without passing through the reception area. No one goes down to the offices without being buzzed down. People just don't wander in here. Do we need one of those signs here? No firearms. By the way, I mean, if you weren't sure about whether we want you to bring your gun in here, don't, please. Leave it in the car. What about your church? Now, the law says that if you are at a stadium of more than 5,000 people or federal buildings, things like that, state buildings, or churches, you can't bring in your guns. But, you know, people forget. They bring in their cell phones and leave them on during church all the time. Should you have, as a reminder, outside your church, oh, by the way, in case you were wondering whether we want you to bring your gun to church, please don't. Leave it at home or leave it in the car. Do you think your church needs a no firearms sign? We'll talk about that during Open Lines. And then in the last hour of the program, in our continuing series on our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October, Lift High This Cross, The Theology of Martin Luther, we'll be talking about the heart and the soul of the Reformation, the sinner's justification. Dr. Martin Nolan from the Concordia Historical Institute joins us here in Studio A in the third hour of Issues Etc. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Pastor Marcus Zill is pastor of St. Andrew's Lutheran Church and Campus Center in Laramie, Wyoming. Pastor Zill, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Hey, good to be back with you, Todd.
You certainly have seen the Time Magazine article, The New Face of Gay Power. It centers on Wyoming and has quite a section on Laramie and the University of Wyoming. What's your general reaction to this?
Well, my first reaction is that when they call that Wyoming the new gay frontier, that's not quite what the State Tourism Board probably wants. But I shared this with my students last night, about 20 of them. And, you know, frankly, there's a lot of stuff that is just the stuff of tall tales that's in this new Time magazine piece.
You arrived at St. Andrews and as campus pastor there shortly after the Matthew Shepard murder. Am I correct?
Yeah, I was here within about 2 months, I think. I was installed in early December, just following it, almost 5 years ago.
Tell us about that time.
Well, it was rather interesting getting a call to Laramie right after this was still fairly fresh in the news. Most of the campus ministries were pushing the gay agenda, except for ours, and I've spoken about this on your program perhaps a couple times before, that we actually ended up kind of bearing a fairly bold witness on campus in terms of what God actually says about homosexuality. It was fairly tumultuous. You had the Reverend Fred Phelps from Kansas. That's the guy that goes around with all the die homosexual type signs and kind of the raucous. In fact, he's trying to get a monument put up in the Casper, Wyoming, where Matthew Shepard was from, in their city park, that depicts Matthew Shepard in hell as a witness to homosexuals, as an alleged witness. So it was that's going on right now. But he comes here every fall, and it's been fairly tumultuous. It was very tumultuous those first few months, but nothing like the media has made it out to be either.
In the Time magazine article, and I'm sure you found this interesting, Laramie, your hometown, it was called the Berkeley of Wyoming. I think probably describing it in terms of the fact that the university exists there and that it's kind of the more free and easy lifestyle, if one can describe the lifestyle of Wyoming that way. Is that a fair assessment of Laramie?
I'll just tell you that my college students just went, Berkeley? This is Berkeley? They just got the biggest kick out of that because, you know, they're alluding to the fact that, they say in the article that this place has always had a liberal aura, and relatively speaking, I don't think that's true. I think every college campus has a liberal aura to some degree, but to say that this is the Berkeley of California is actually it's hysterical, actually, because Laramie is, you know, and Wyoming in general, is a fairly conservative state. When I compare notes with my other fellow campus pastors at other places, they probably would get a kick out of thinking of Laramie as a Berkeley too.
And there's a group apparently located there in Laramie at the four-year University of Wyoming called Spectrum that gets some discussion in the Time magazine article. How prominent is that pro-homosexual group?
Well, I had to ask my students about it since I hadn't heard about it, and I'm on campus quite a bit and other such things. And what it is, it's the former Lesbian, Gay, Transgendered Association. They just came up with a new name, which kind of hypes the rainbow kind of gay symbol in terms of Spectrum. The article says it's one of the most vibrant gay college groups in the West, and I don't know if I would consider it vibrant. You know, it's not any more than it ever was, but the media has so overblown the awareness of gay issues on this campus. It's been a non-issue for the most part ever since, you know, about a year after Matthew Shepard's death. I don't think there's more gays here than there were before, and I don't think they're vibrant if you would compare their group to any other normal institution.
What was the reaction on campus, generally speaking, among the student and the faculty, the campus community there at the University of Wyoming right after Matthew Shepard's death?
Well, people were horrified at anybody being murdered. This is a small town atmosphere, 30,000 people. People come to Laramie to come to school because, in part because of that. We just don't have murders here very often. Of course, there was horror over that. It was a shame that it happened to a university student. Of course, the initial push was everything about the gay agenda, even though I found interesting this article actually recognizes that robbery and drugs may have also been other factors, which is something that most everybody here locally has known ever since the beginning, that this wasn't just about being gay. In fact, it may have had nothing to do with the fact that Matthew Shepard was gay, or very minimally anyways.
So in other words, the way that Matthew Shepard's murder has been portrayed largely in the national media as simply a case of two guys out to do harm to a gay guy and they succeeded, in fact, did it in a gruesome way, may not be entirely the truth.
No, it's not. They, you know, did they know he was gay? Well, perhaps. Who knows? You know, and everybody here in Laramie, we've endured the Laramie Project, an HBO special, and some campuses across the union have been putting on plays with that, and they make Laramie out to be the sick town out west, and there's even a scene in that Laramie Project of a gay rancher, which everybody out here just kind of giggles at, who talks about how we can finally go to a bar in Laramie and doesn't have to go to Colorado. But the liberal agenda, the homosexual agenda, have really, I think, done a disservice to Laramie and to Matthew Shepard, even himself, and turning him into this martyr crucifixion type figure, and seize this in order to advance their agenda in a place where it really wasn't warranted.
After the murder of Matthew Shepard, how did the, generally speaking, and of course you were new there, but how did the other campus ministries react to the murder? What was their reaction, as opposed to the reaction that that St. Andrew's Lutheran Church and Campus Center?
Well, most of them were pushing the pro-gay agenda. The Roman Catholic campus ministry was front and central in that, and they still have their annual mass to celebrate the life and the teachings of Matthew Shepard. Not sure what he taught, but some of that continues today. They had a religious panels on homosexuality and Christianity, and most of the other campus ministries seized as an opportunity to push the gay agenda, except for ours. I mean, most of our students would say it's a horrible thing that Matthew Shepard died. Nobody deserves to be murdered and such. But we're equally concerned about everybody acting as if homosexuality is suddenly okay just because a heinous murder took place.
You've been there in Wyoming for about 5 years. What do you make of the assessment in the Time magazine article that Wyoming is a don't ask, don't tell state when it comes to homosexuality?
Well, I've never heard most any of that articulated here, and certainly most of what this writer writes doesn't sound like the Wyoming that I live in. However, you do very much have an attitude, and this is a Western attitude in general, that people are out here because they love the rugged individualism, and they have their ranches, and they do their own thing, and for the most part, if you don't do anything to affect or bother me, you can live your own life how you please. But that doesn't translate to all of a sudden the Wild West becoming the new gay frontier. That's just simply a joke.
So why do you think the Time magazine article, other than the fact that Matthew Shepard was murdered in Wyoming, why do you think they are seeking to portray Wyoming as kind of the new gay frontier, this new kind of libertarian landscape where maybe there's a new way for gays to come out of the closet and be accepted?
Well, Wyoming, when you conjure up pictures of Wyoming in your mind, you think of the frontier. I think it's all summed up in this gay frontier attitude that he's trying to portray, and he mentioned several times, that this is a place where people can do what they want and do what they please. Most of them happen to be fairly conservative. But it's kind of that new frontier. We're always looking for new frontiers, and for many, the homosexual agenda is the new frontier of the future. And so I can kind of see how they're trying to use what is positive about Wyoming and use it for their own advantage.
And as someone who's obviously concerned about the students at a large university like University of Wyoming, what should the proper Christian attitude be toward the gay students, whether they be members of the activist groups or not?
Well, I talk with my students about this a lot, and part of the reason why I spent some time with them last night going through this article was to prepare them for whatever might take place here in the next couple of weeks as this fifth anniversary is celebrated in the media agenda, and perhaps they'll see all sorts of things that they maybe, especially the freshmen, didn't know existed before they got here. But basically, I think the Christian student needs to be aware of what the agenda is. so that they are conscious about what is being pushed on them. But they also need to be aware that many of these people are not just embracing their homosexuality, but many of them are hurting. And so we need to be there to have a presence to let people know that there is a church where you can go to where you will not get coddled in your sin, but that you'll have people that genuinely care to help you lead you out of it. And there are those. We've had one or two individuals come by our place specifically over the last few years because they knew that homosexuality was wrong and they needed somebody to talk to about it.
Is that your general perception, especially with the younger, the student-aged young adults, that although they may say, okay, I've come to grips with it, I'm gay, they are still strongly ambivalent about their so-called orientation? They're troubled by it.
Well, I think many of them are. Most teenagers or college-age students struggle with matters of conscience with all sorts of other things. It's not just particularly a homosexual issue. Of course, many of them are feeling freer with coming out, so to speak. But I think it's an ambivalent age. On the one hand, you have them pushing towards the new frontier of college and independence. And on the other hand, they're coming to grips with the fact that deep down inside they have a lot of hurt. Teenagers today are just filled with hurt and anger and pain and suffering, and that's true for homosexuals just as it would be for any student.
Do you think that the college-age kids today are comfortable with the whole notion of multiple genders? That's one of the things that comes through in the Time magazine article, but also generally in the rhetoric of gay activism, and that is, look, it's not just that there's straight and gay. There's straight and gay and transgendered and bisexual and any other variety that one can think up. Are the kids today comfortable with that?
No, I don't think they are at all. We certainly don't see those other such things pushed here. But I don't think they are. In fact, I think this upcoming generation has a lot more going for it in terms of understanding these issues than perhaps the one that's preceded them, namely their parents. Their parents came through the 60s where everything was about pushing the envelope as hard as you can in terms of other liberal agendas and freedom, and this generation is starting to see the result and the fruits, for negative or for positive, but perhaps mostly negative in terms of what we're reaping because of that. And I actually think most of our typical students, whether they're Christians or not, are looking for something a little bit more substantive than what they've seen pushed around them.
The Time magazine article kind of bemoans, in the person of former Republican Senator Alan Simpson, bemoans the fact that the gay activist groups nationally have decided to kind of, he thinks they've jumped the gun on the issue of gay marriage. They should be happy with the progress they've made so far. And he's quite a sympathizer to their cause. But he says, look, bringing up gay marriage is like dragging around a dead cat. No one wants to talk about that. Now it's putting everyone in an awkward position. What do college students today make of this new construct, gay marriage?
Oh, well, I would say that nearly every single student that I've ever talked to, Lutheran, Christian or not, thinks that that would be absolutely undermining our entire societal framework. I want to add that this whole Alan Simpson thing, he's a very prominent figure out here, kind of like Dick Cheney would be. None of the 20 students I talked to, any of us had ever heard of this, the Cody Republican group, that the gentleman who wrote this article acts as if it's some huge deal out here, and I can't even find anybody than Cody that's ever heard of it. So that kind of took me a little bit by surprise. I'm going to have to learn a little bit more about this group, but that's often what happens. You know, we've witnessed for 5 years now the liberal media making up all sorts of things that have allegedly happened in Laramie, or they happened and two people showed up to it and they make it sound like it was a crowd. But I don't think our young people, I think they're probably stronger on that issue than perhaps many of their parents might be.
I'm thinking about the parents who send their kid away to school, and perhaps one of their biggest unspoken fears is, look, the university is a wild and woolly place. My kid may go off and after their freshman year come back and say, guess what? I'm gay. I met someone, we're roommates, now I'm gay. Biggest fear they might have. Is that fear overblown? Is it really that dangerous in that way on the university campus?
Well, Todd, as you probably well know, the homosexual action groups claim that, 10% of the country is gay. If that were true, and I don't believe it is, that translated onto our college campuses, that would mean one out of every 10 students would be gay, if not perhaps a little bit more at that younger age. I asked my students today, we were having our midweek meal last night, we have a little devotion around the table, and I asked them how many of them knew somebody that was gay, and I'd say maybe one or two of them raised their hands out of about 20. I do think it's overblown. It does happen. I'm sure every year there's one or two people that finds out that their roommate is a homosexual, but that's one or two people out of hundreds, if not thousands. It's not an epidemic by any stretch of the imagination.
And how do you counsel your students to deal with that situation, the friend who they find out is gay, the roommate who they find out is gay?
Well, I've actually never been in that situation in 5 years. I've never had a single student point out to me that their roommate was coming out, or they found out right away that they were gay. In short, it just hasn't happened to any of the students that I've run across, which says a little bit about how widespread it really isn't.
How would you counsel them to deal with that initially?
Well, that's a tough thing, because on the one hand, God has presented you with an incredible opportunity to witness to somebody to your faith. On the other hand, it'd be nice to be able to witness to them without having to necessarily continue as roommates. I would probably encourage them to continue to cultivate the relationship so that they can stay in touch with that person. But I don't believe our young people need to be. I'm not one that would say, no, you got to stay there and sleep with your in the same room with your lesbian roommate, just so that you can witness. Because frankly, I think our young people need as much shelter as they can, especially when there's so much other stuff they have to deal with on campus. So I'd probably encourage them to seek to get another roommate, but still keep their ties with that person so that they can have the chance to not think that they've just kind of left them and aren't going to continue talking with them.
Pastor Marcus Zill, thank you for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me, Todd.
Pastor Marcus Zill is pastor of St. Andrew's Lutheran Church and Campus Center in Laramie, Wyoming. By the way, St. Andrew's has a great website, it really does, with some very helpful resources. The address is standrewslcms.org, standrewslcms.org. When we come back from this break, Dr. Jeffrey Satinover joins us. He is a former fellow in psychiatry and child psychiatry at Yale University and a former lecturer in psychology and religion at Harvard University. There's a new study published in the October issue of Behavioral Neuroscience. It's a journal that suggests people might be born gay. Well, Dr. Satinover has looked into not only that research, but also a lot of previous research that has been touted in the press to be, well, we found the gay gene, people are born this way, it is not learned, it is inherited. We'll see what he makes of all those claims when we come back.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Most Protestant Christians claim the legacy of Martin Luther and of the Reformation. However, few that make this claim are actually familiar with Luther's theology, much less the events of the Reformation. Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October, Lift High This Cross, The Theology of Martin Luther, provides a concise review of the very events we call the Reformation. It explores the driving ideas of the Reformation through the writings of Luther and the other reformers. Order Lift High This Cross by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, or order online, issuesetc.org. When you call or write, mention Issues Etc. Call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, or visit issuesetc.org.
Now this Global Minute lets you hear that when God calls you into a service, He's also getting ready to teach you something. That's what a short-term missionary experienced in India. A campus full of children who were rescued from life-threatening situations greeted Brittany, a young woman who ministered briefly at the Ramabai Mukti Mission in India. She helped teach English to fourth graders, played games with disabled residents at Mukti, and visited with the widows. She discovered how Christian love and concern truly saves lives in India. Pray for short-term mission workers to have open hearts for what God is teaching them. Pray also for the long-term staff and residents at Mukti to find continual strength in Christ's love, whether it's during school, Bible studies, or free time. Learn about helping children and the poor in India with a free copy of the magazine on India. Call 1-800-268-0461. That's 1-800-268-0461.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Years ago, I was teaching religion class to the eighth graders at our parochial school. One day, I had enough of their picking on each other, their cliquishness, their hurtful behavior. So I unloaded the standard grown-up lecture that they had probably heard a million times. "Pastor, you've got it wrong," interrupted a courageous girl. "What? How's that?" I asked. "The reason we act that way is we are afraid we're not going to fit in." Why does that office worker hoard information that would help the rest of you do your job? Why does the up-and-coming professional hide the fact that he's drowning in debt? Why does the fearful woman present herself as having it all together? Is there any way that some of your own behavior grows out of a fear that in some way you're not going to fit in? Because we compartmentalize our hectic lives, security in one area of life does not afford security in another. What we need is a security that embraces every aspect of daily life, a centered sense that it is well with my soul, whatever might try to scare us. Jesus says, "Come unto me," Matthew 11:28.
On the next Focus on the Family.
It's my belief that the high divorce rate in this country results at least in part from the failure of newlyweds to understand what love really is and what it isn't, and how to make sense out of their emotions.
Dr. James Dobson instructs teens on the real meaning of love. How do you know if it's true love or just a crush? A lesson to learn while you're young. Next time on Focus on the Family.
Weekdays at 9:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. There's a new study published in the October issue of Behavioral Neuroscience that suggests that people might be born gay. And this isn't the first time we've heard. For about the last 5-6 years, it's been kind of a regular thing every couple of months. On the radio, on television, in the newspaper, there'll be a headline, something about the genetic origins of homosexuality. And usually the conclusions are pretty uniform. The conclusions are, look, if it is in fact inherited, if it is in fact a matter of biology in the brain and not behavioral, not learned, then how can we say it's wrong? If that's not said explicitly, it is often implied. We're going to find out about this new study and other research that seems to suggest that people might be born gay, it might be genetic, and we'll find out whether or not the research actually is able to carry that water. Dr. Jeffrey Settenover is our guest. He's practiced psychoanalysis for more than 25 years and psychiatry for more than 15. He's formerly a fellow in psychiatry and child psychiatry at Yale University and a former lecturer in psychology and religion at Harvard University. He holds degrees from MIT, the University of Texas, and Harvard. He's author of the book Homosexuality and the Politics of Truth. Dr. Settenover, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you very much, Todd. Glad to be here.
Tell us about the new study in behavioral neuroscience. What does it say precisely?
Well, basically, the study says that that there is a difference in the startle response between subjects who are homosexual and subjects that are heterosexual. And since there's some evidence that the startle response may be inborn, that therefore the researchers conclude homosexuality might be an inborn trait. At least that's what the researchers conclude.
Is that a necessary conclusion, given the research that was done?
As a matter of fact, no. It is extraordinarily weak research, and the conclusion doesn't follow at all.
How is that? Explain it to us.
Well, for example, it's well known that Tourette's syndrome is associated with an exaggerated startle response, and Tourette's syndrome is, amongst other things, is associated with an increased exposure to the same virus that that causes people to develop certain kinds of heart infections and strep throat and a number of other conditions. It's also associated with certain kinds of brain disorders and neurologic conditions. So we know that there are environmental pathogens that can cause neurologic conditions that are acquired outside of the womb that are associated with an increased startle response. So right off the bat, we know that the conclusion that an increased startle response is an inborn condition is a false conclusion to begin with. I mean, right there's a problem.
So in other words, just because someone exhibits an increased startle response, and just because those who are tested show a higher startle response among those who are homosexual than those who are heterosexual, it does not necessarily follow that you can say, okay, we know startle response is inborn. You're saying, no, it isn't. Therefore, homosexuality, since it coincides here, must also be inborn.
That's right. I mean, I just picked one example of a problem with this research. There are many other kinds of problems. If it were true, which it isn't, but if it were true that the startle response were definitively known to be an inborn trait, and then somebody showed beyond a shadow of a doubt, which this research does not, that homosexuality was very, very strongly associated with a startle response, even then it would not follow that homosexuality was inborn. And let me give you a quick explanation as to why that's the case. It would be extremely easy to show that basketball playing has an extremely strong genetic determination. That does not mean that there is a gene for basketball playing. That sounds like a contradiction. But it's not, because we all know that tall people are much more likely to become basketball players than short people. That doesn't mean that there's a gene for basketball playing. It means that there's a gene for height. And if there were a gene for a startle response, and that gene were associated also with homosexuality, it would not mean that homosexuality was inherited, just as it does not mean that simply because there's a gene for height that basketball playing is inherited. This is an extraordinarily common confusion that is relentlessly perpetrated. I don't know for what reason, but even reputable scientists refuse to be clear about the difference between genetic association and genetic causation. I suppose it's because we live in an era in which politics trumps even truth.
It's actually just a basic logical fallacy, assuming that two things that happen to coincide, one must cause the other. I mean, it's a basic but logical fallacy, isn't it?
It is. It's elementary. It used to be taught in elementary school and junior high school and high school. Now, apparently, people can get PhDs and publish papers and just will not refrain from making politically loaded statements instead of simply publishing dispassionate scientific research and letting the conclusions speak for themselves.
All right. So how is it that we've been hearing for the last decade now that they, whoever they might be, have found the gay gene?
Well, I suppose we've been hearing it for the last decade because of the political implications that are associated with it. Namely, most people conclude that if it's genetic, therefore it must be unchangeable. That's why we hear about it. The fact of the matter is that there is not the slightest bit of evidence for a gay gene, and whether there were a gay gene or were not a gay gene would have no bearing whatsoever on the debate over whether it is a good thing or a bad thing. That question must be argued on completely other grounds, and I will assert on the basis of scientific facts that there is no gay gene. That does not mean that homosexuality is a bad thing. It does not mean that it's a good thing. It is simply a matter of fact that there is no gay gene.
So, in other words, I guess it raises the broader question of behavioral genes, whether there are genes that determine behavior. You say that's kind of a yes and no answer.
Well, if we're going to be precise, and I'm going to be precise.
Yes.
There are no genes under any circumstances that determine, the key word here is determine, there are no genes under any circumstances whatsoever that determine behavior. There are certainly genes that have an influence on behavior. For example, there are genes that make it more likely that one will never become a basketball player. For instance, I have certain genes that make it extremely unlikely that I will ever be a member of the New York Knicks. I happen to be short. So, you know, there goes my career as a professional basketball player. But I don't have genes. I could never have had genes that would ever have made it absolutely certain that I would become a New York Knick. No matter how tall I was, it is not possible that there are genes that would determine beyond a shadow of a doubt that I would ever become anything. There are only genes that can influence and make certain things more likely. There are genes that would place me at risk, for example, for becoming a great artist or for becoming a cad. There are genes that would place me at risk for becoming creative or for becoming more feminine or for becoming more masculine, for becoming thoughtful or for becoming mean. But then there are all kinds of experiences in life that will influence which way I go. There's the mystery of free will. There's fortune. Time and chance happeneth to all men. There's what I choose to make of my life, probably the most important thing of all.
So this really is not so much a question about whether or not there's a gay gene. This is really a question about what role do our genes play in, quote-unquote, determining any behavior or any outcome. It's a much broader question.
It's a huge question, and, you know, and overshadowing it all is the, you know, the great mystery of what do we do with the cards that have been dealt us. It is certainly likely that there are factors, amongst them genetic, that will place people at risk for becoming homosexual. But there are definitely no set of genes that will force people to become homosexual.
Now, another line of research has been twin studies. Explain to us how that works, or how it's supposed to work, and how what we've just discussed informs how we evaluate the conclusions that are drawn from these twin studies.
Sure. Well, twin studies basically say, and, you know, I'll boil it down to its simplest form. Twin studies basically say if you've got two identical twins and fortune intervenes and they're raised, they're separated at birth and they're raised in completely different environments, you would expect that if homosexuality were like eye color, that if one twin has blue eyes and blonde hair, that the other one is going to have blue eyes and blonde hair. Well, so too, if you look at 1,000 such twins separated at birth, that if 500 of those twin pairs are heterosexual, their partners are all going to be heterosexual, and 500 of them are homosexual, the other matching 500 are going to be homosexual. That's referred to as a concordance rate of 100%. They're always going to match up. Well, it turns out that the matching up rate for sexual orientation amongst identical twins that have been separated at birth is less than 50%. It's not 100%. Now, it's higher than just random. It's higher than what you find, for example, amongst siblings that are separated at birth, siblings that aren't identical twins, but it's much, much lower than 100%. And this tells the wise geneticist, in fact, it tells the people who conducted these studies, who then said in their own papers that they were surprised. They performed these studies because they were looking to find confirmatory evidence that homosexuality is genetic, and they were confounded, and they had to admit that it really demonstrated that the environment must play a very large role in the determination of sexuality. So the twin studies actually confirm that homosexuality cannot be genetic, that, well, yes, there may be some kind of genetic influence. Clearly, environment plays an enormous role.
Folks, if you have a question or a comment on the question, is homosexuality genetic, feel free to give us a call now. 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Our guest is Dr. Jeffrey Satinover. Dr. Satinover, so where does the failure lie, given the fact that it is a rather regular occurrence for us to read or hear or see on television that researchers are again confirming the genetic basis, the genetic cause for homosexuality? Does the failure lie with the researchers, or with the way it's being reported, or with our own ignorance and inability to understand what the research is actually saying?
Well, I'm afraid that our society, like most societies throughout history, is going through a period of time where we are more wedded to what we wish to be true than to what is true. And instead of dispassionately approaching the evidence as it is, We're engaged in a quest to alter reality to suit our tastes. And at the moment, for a mixture of all kinds of reasons, many of them, I think, have good intentions behind them. Much of the push for gay rights is driven by good intentions and a sense of compassion, and the man in the street does not care for gay bashing and does not care for the vilification and hatred that has in fact been directed towards gays from many quarters, and is quite sympathetic to the idea that that there is no place for that kind of hatred and for bigotry, and is sympathetic to these arguments. And based on that, is susceptible to arguments that more or less appeal to sympathy, and therefore is open to arguments that are oftentimes nonetheless being pushed forward aggressively by people who are themselves not necessarily sympathetic, but are driven by politics. And they say, their attitude is basically, I have an agenda, I have a goal, and I'm going to get to my goal regardless of what the truth is, and reality be damned. These may be the facts, and I don't care what the facts are. I know that if I make the argument that homosexuality is genetic and I can convince people of that, I'm going to gain sympathy for my cause, and so that's what I'm going to do. And they go out and do it. The news media is, in my opinion, notoriously indifferent to facts when they conflict with what they see is in the best interest of the public, and oftentimes will say whatever they think is going to push their point of view.
So it strikes me that the researchers, in order to have some integrity as researchers and kind of be able to face one another at the next conference, have to be able to, even if they have an agenda, cover themselves when they publish their research. Do you find this, where they cover themselves, but they couch it in language that the press is unlikely to either understand or be interested in?
Oh, very often. I mean, actually, in this area, it's quite ironic. All they need to do is say, for example, they say to the press, we found that that there is an extremely high heritability for homosexuality, more than 50% heritability. And that statement is technically true, and it'll immediately get translated as homosexuality is more than 50% inherited. Most people who are not trained geneticists will not realize that, for example, 75% heritability means almost nothing. Heritability needs to be almost 100% for it to be anything significant. 75% heritability is trivial. And most geneticists won't waste their time investigating traits that have heritability of less than 75%.
So what's the difference between something that is heritable and something that is inherited?
Well, the example would be the one I gave about basketball playing. Basketball playing is probably around 80% heritable, meaning if you look at the percentage of basketball players that are under, 6 feet, what would you guess? Professional basketball players under 6 feet tall.
Very few.
Probably less than 1%. So if you look at the, if you define basketball playing, which you know, free to do, if you define professional basketball playing as basketball playing, professional basketball playing is probably not at 99% heritable. Basketball playing in general is less so because, you know, there are non-professional basketball playing. But basketball, professional basketball playing, because it requires such enormous athleticism and height, you know, what I mean by that is if you look at the parents of professional basketball playing, professional basketball players, I would be willing to bet that upwards of 90% of them are over 6 feet tall themselves. So you, if you didn't know that it was height that was the salient trait and instead looked for parents who were themselves basketball players, parents of professional basketball players who themselves played basketball as youngsters. And, you know, to be clever about this, let's restrict ourselves to fathers. I'll bet you could find maybe 80% of professional basketball players had fathers who played basketball. So you then come to the conclusion that basketball, professional basketball playing is about 80% heritable.
But that says nothing about the nature of the genetic association. It says far more about the fact that dad, who realizes his son is going to turn out to be taller than him and has a love for basketball, says, son, let's go out and shoot some hoops.
Now we're off and running into a debate as to whether there's a gene for basketball playing or is it a family trait. And then we could start having, you know, now let's look at children, identical twins who have been adopted away at birth and see how many of them become basketball players, et cetera, et cetera. The whole thing is ludicrous because, of course, in this instance, we know that the salient trait isn't basketball playing, it's height and athleticism.
There's one other field of research that is often touted in the press as being definitively a demonstration that homosexuality is simply a matter of birth. And that is, look, when you look at the homosexual brains in autopsy, you will find that certain portions of the homosexual brain are enlarged or smaller, whatever the case may be, than those of heterosexuals. And therefore, this must be a matter of biology in the brain.
Right. Yeah, that was actually very interesting. The history of that particular study, Simon LeVay, who was a neuroanatomist out in San Francisco, first studied that. He later actually retracted his statement that it demonstrated that it was a matter of birth. Because, well, first of all, let me give you a living example. It turns out that people who become blind after birth, if you do an autopsy on their brains, the part of the brain responsible for the finger, for finger movement, is greatly enlarged as a consequence of their having learned Braille, an illustration of the fact that brain tissue increases in size with use. And so the editor of the research that LeVay did was published in Science. The editor of Nature, the competing major science magazine, commented on the research that, in fact, it's just as likely that the region of the brain that was found enlarged in these men could just as easily have gotten larger during life as a consequence of their experience rather than its being a cause of their experience. And newspaper people immediately made fun of this, not realizing that it was the editor of Nature who made the comment, but attributing it to some fundamentalist Christians who must have been poorly educated and easily led. Only then it turned out that even the author of the article admitted that, well, yes, of course, it certainly could have been an effect rather than a cause. And subsequently, there was evidence to show that it was extremely likely that that was indeed just the effect. And that goes actually, it speaks to the original article that we were discussing today to begin with that started off this interview, that this business of the startle response, the claim that it is an innate, an inborn trait, there's lots of evidence that it is not an innate inborn trait. And as ridiculous as it will sound to most people, most neuroscientists actually understand full well that the brain is an extremely plastic organ that alters itself dramatically in response to experience. And there's no evidence whatsoever that an altered startle response is an innate trait. It is far more likely, in my opinion, actually, that the same experiences that generated the altered sexuality produced the increased startle response, for example.
Could you stay with us for just a minute after this break?
Sure.
Because we're up against a break that we can't move, and when we come back, I'd like you to finish your thought, because that's crucial, and I have one more question for Dr. Jeffrey Satinover. He's a former fellow in psychiatry and child psychiatry at Yale and a former lecturer in psychology and religion at Harvard University. We're talking about whether or not people are born gay.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.
Issues Etc. is underwritten in part locally by Christ Our Savior Lutheran Church in Freeburg, Illinois. Christ Our Savior is located at 612 North State Street in Freeburg. The Reverend Bruce Kaseman is the pastor. Their phone number, area code 618-539-5664, 539-5664. Christ Our Savior Lutheran Church in Freeburg, an Issues Etc. underwriter on AM 850 KFUO.